This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Lisa, Becca, and Kate. Thanks for your support, friends. You can become a Blotter Presents tipster at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And certain levels of support entitle you to pick a property for me to live tweet, which, just a reminder, I will be doing again this Saturday, October 27th, with the Drew Barrymore, Amy Fisher TV movie trifecta, chosen by Scott. Provided my copy of the Milano Amy Fisher TV movie arrives at my house, U.S. Postal Service, hear my cry. That will be happening at 8 p.m. Eastern, and those live tweets are open to everyone, of course. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at Blotter Presents to watch along. And now, on with the show.
This could have happened to you. This could have happened to any of your family members.
I have to kill somebody first.
The sheriff department framed these.
Don't let Netflix tell you what to think!
Making a Murderer returns for part two with a new star attorney and the same old questions about due process, coerced confessions, and a documentary's obligation to both sides. Paul Bernardo returned to the North American consciousness with a parole hearing last week, and we're contemplating Carla, the 2006 film about his already paroled partner in crime, or Emotional Hostage, depending on what you believe, starring Laura Prepon? Eve Beatty returns to discuss brain fingerprinting, perm merkins, and a good wife wardrobe closet's worth of talking head jackets in The Blotter Presents, episode 73. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, devoted to the principle that crime is bad, but some of the stories about crime can be really good. Some of them. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm joined once again by retail proprietrix and my narratee, Eve Beatty. Hello again, Eve.
Hey, Sarah.
How are you on this fine day?
I'm pretty good. I probably should have warned you. I am talking to everyone from my mother's home in Indiana. There are children running around. You know, this is not a vast estate, unlike the Bernardo's estate. So, you might occasionally hear a child. I promise it is not one of my captives.
That's
my captives are gagged. Yeah.
Yeah, you're a professional.
Yeah.
Speaking of professional, let's talk about the latest Netflix true crime installation. I'm speaking, of course, of Making a Murderer Part 2. I can't imagine that anyone who is listening to this on purpose doesn't already know what Making a Murderer Parts 1 or 2 is about, but just in case, here's the case file. Almost 3 years ago, Moira Demos and Laura Ricciardi's Making a Murderer, excuse me if I mispronounced those names, I'm pretty sure I did, debuted on Netflix, shining a light on the convictions of Stephen Avery and his nephew Brendan Dassey for the 2005 murder of Teresa Halbach. Avery had already spent 18 years in prison for a rape he didn't commit. Dassey, who confessed to helping Avery murder Halbach, was an intellectually limited 16-year-old who didn't seem to know anything about the crime that the police hadn't suggested to him. And prosecutor Ken Kratz drew the ire of the nation for his smarmily disingenuous, quote, hosting of the trial. But not everyone felt the filmmakers did right by the victim or by their overall subject. And Demos and Ricciardi were accused of a one-sided account of the crime and trials bent on exonerating Avery and Dassey. Those debates have never really stopped, and the filmmakers didn't stop either, following the post-conviction relief efforts of Avery and Dassey. The entrance of renowned conviction vacatrix Kathleen Zellner and her fantastic Manny into the case, and the fraying of the men's families as they continue to serve the sentences with their son and brother. Part 2 landed on Netflix last Friday. Is it the same infuriating, bingeable prospect it was in its first season? Do the filmmakers answer their critics the way some reviews have implied they do? Are we any closer to understanding what may have really happened to Teresa Halbach? That was a lot of questions. I don't really have any answers. Eve, you and I both covered this for previously.tv.
Yeah.
Alf Text when it first, when the first part aired in December. And I have to say, I have always felt a little bit defensive, I guess, or I don't know, like I'm supposed to think that it's, so, you know, one-sided and that that's a big problem. Mm-hmm. But I just don't push back on part one, at least for that, maybe as much as I feel like I'm supposed to. What are your feelings on that, at least in terms of part one? Did you feel that it was very one-sided? And if so, did you really have a problem with that as a consumer of true crime?
Well, I was trying to remember because I feel like you and I had a conversation way back whenever that was, 3 years ago, about sort of like, you know, thinking, how can one better also represent Teresa? And I feel like this is a conversation that, you know, we as a nation also probably had about Serial, where so much of the focus is on, you know, the suspect or the convicted person who may or may not have done it, and the victim, the person who, there's no question, they're dead and they died horribly, sort of falls by the wayside. But the thing is, I don't have a solution for a better way to do this. You know, we do have, you know, Teresa's college friend, talking critically about Zellner tweeting and things like that. But, like, is there a better way to be, you know, to advocate for victims when the focus really is on a legal system that I think we can all agree right now, it just is not grand?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, this is one of my stalking horses, I guess. Certainly my husband, another frequent guest, Dan Patrick Brady, has heard me bitch many times about people complaining that a given documentary property is not objective, quote unquote.
Right.
Like, there are a bunch of issues with the work of Michael Moore. I won't get into them now because I think we all know what they are. But the specious argument that he's not objective, I think, is ridiculous. Like, it's a documentary, not a transcript. That's why we have two different words for that. So I didn't necessarily have an issue with the filmmakers choosing not just what to include and what not to include, because again, it's not a transcript and every documentary is curated in this fashion, whether you're aware of it or not. And there's only so many hours in the day. Like, it couldn't be a 28 part series. And I understand how the world works. But I just don't think it's, first of all, I don't think it disrespects the victim to say, like, due process was not served, justice was not served here. You know, the idea of a trial is to get at some kind of truth, and that, you know, the prosecutors weren't participating in that part of the process. But I also don't think it's, I don't think that by focusing or by looking at the case from this angle, which is the angle that they had access to, because not for nothing, but I think the Halbachs and that side of the aisle weren't communicating with the filmmakers or cooperating with them in any way, which I also don't judge. But how else are you supposed to tell this story and to marshal, you know, hundreds and of thousands of pages of trial transcripts, of talking head interviews, years on end of following these people with cameras? I guess I don't feel that that's a fair standard for anyone.
Well, okay, I'll say this too. Like, you know, in my career as a journalist, a lot of times when you're writing about crime, you will, by, I think, people with their hearts in the right place will accuse you of being pro-cop. They'll say, oh, you're on the side of the police. Okay, why am I on the side of the police? It's because the story that you wrote, these people will say, only takes the police side into account. You know, if you are publishing an account of an alleged robbery or a mugging or something, for example, you'll have what the police have told you. You know, you can call, you talk to the PIO, that public information officer, and they'll tell you, this is, you know, what the victim said regarding the mugging. This is what happened. But, you know, and we arrested so-and-so for the case and all that. But, like, here's the thing. As a reporter, that's what we have. We have what the police told us. You know, maybe if we're lucky, you know, somehow we'll get in touch with the victim and we'll get that. It's very rare that we're talking to the suspect. And that's probably for the best because, you know, if there's a trial, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, a lot of times when you're writing about a, you know, a crime that just happened, there isn't a defense attorney yet, and or those people don't get back to you, so you're telling a story, like you said, based on who's participating and who's willing to talk. And so, yeah, sometimes that means that it's going to seem one-sided. But I, to say that, I don't want that to suggest that I feel like anybody has an obligation to talk to reporters or documentarians or anything else, because otherwise a story might be bad. Don't talk to anyone you don't want to talk to. I'm really serious about that. I say this as a journalist. I'm not... Yeah, I don't want anyone to think that it's like you deserve what you get if you don't talk to reporters. But, you know, all of us, like, if you think that these people who are making this movie, you know, or a movie or a TV series or writing a story are, you know, going at this with any agenda other than we want to tell this story, then, you know, then ask those questions. If you really think that they're making stuff up or they're trying to twist things, I think you should ask those questions. But if it's just like, well, you only told this one side of it, then I think it's wise to ask why that is. And when you get to that last screen on Netflix that shows the names, and I think I tweeted this at you, Sarah, right?
Yes, you
did. Of all the people who declined to participate in the documentary, like, you'll see that they actually did a pretty remarkable job of getting a lot of sides to something that, you know, when a lot of people did not want to talk at all.
Yeah, including Nancy Grace, Jeanine Pirro.
Oh, yeah.
Ken Kratz, who I think this is quite possibly the only outlet in the English-speaking world Ken Kratz didn't whore himself out to between leaving the prosecutor's office and this very moment. He wrote a book, he went on Dateline, and, you know, I really don't feel like the word of those particular commentators is, like, these are big voices in the, it was very one-sided and you didn't see a lot of the evidence against Stephen Avery chorus. Let's hear clip two. Warning, contains Nancy Grace, and Jeanine Pirro, and Ken Kratz, and Dr. Phil.
You can't plant sweat. How do you leave that out of the documentary?
Not aired in the Netflix documentary, DNA found inside the hood latch, which, according to Kratz, came from the skin and sweat of Avery's fingers.
The DNA was sweat.
DNA evidence from sweat.
Sweat DNA is not something that, you know, you just carry around with you and slap under the hood of a car.
Well, maybe not on Long Island, Judge Pirro, but apparently in Manitowoc, that's that's how they're doing it. Although, well, whatever. We can get more into the forensic testing a little later. But yeah, I just don't... I mean... If this is how you see the documentary, then this is how you see the documentary. But I feel like the evidence against Stephen Avery, at least in part one, was fairly well laid out because they were trying to make the point that a lot of it was like ridiculous. So,
well, can we talk a little bit more about this? So, you know, the documentary begins with sort of this media montage of, you know, that acknowledging, and I can't think of a way not, you know, that they couldn't, acknowledging the impact that this series had and how it was so much part of the conversation. But isn't it crazy, Sarah, how it also feels like this rogues gallery of shitty media men?
Yeah.
I mean, like, that had to be intentional, right? Like, Or I don't know, maybe not. Maybe it's pretty hard to like pull together like a bunch of media stuff without getting a couple alleged sexual harassers or assailants. But it was like, we had a couple of beats on Matt Lauer. We had a couple of beats on Charlie Rose. And I'm sure that there were other people in there that I've, you know, forgotten since it's been a few days. There were a lot of bad guys there talking about the case when we see all of the media discussion of it initially. And I thought to myself, this had to be on purpose.
Yeah, I couldn't decide about that because there certainly was no shortage.
It was something that, I mean, I'm not saying like, oh, you know, this restaurant only gets one Yelp star because I couldn't find parking, but it was like sort of distracting in a way for me. And I also think, you know, there's nothing wrong with saying it would be so disingenuous to be like, hey, so we're just making season two and hey, I don't know if you guys saw the last one or what, but there was something about that. I don't know. Like, I don't know. I wish you guys would tweet at us and let us know what you think, because I'm really struggling to think, like, were they trying to, was there some sort of subtext to that? I don't know. Maybe I'm looking at too much. I don't know. Tweet us.
Yeah. Let us know if that's something that you noticed, because, and, you know, part of the reason I brought up the one-sidedness is that some of the reviews that I was reading before I really dug into part two, and I have now seen the whole thing, some of the reviews were saying that the filmmakers did address those accusations, which,
yeah.
Okay, like my objection to the word accusation in this context, let's, you know, stipulate it. But I also didn't really feel like they did that. And I thought that was fine, because I think that these are now women who are experienced enough with this story and with working in this story that they may have looked at the response to part one and heard the calls upon them to be more even-handed. But I think they assessed those comments and thought, you know, this would be disingenuous for us to sort of set aside 20 minutes, 40 minutes, a whole episode, whatever it is, performatively trying to get the cooperation of the Halbach family, which they're not going to give, which, as you said, no, that's a value neutral statement. They're not having it. Mm-hmm. And trying to what is the word I want here? Not absolve themselves, but like, oh, we heard your critique and we've taken that note that they were like, well, we heard your critique, but that's not
like
what we're doing
here.
It's
the editor's note to readers. You know, we realized that you were concerned about our tweet where we called, you know, black people a bad word or something, and we're going to fix it and we're going to listen better from now on or something. You know, yeah, I mean, I think that so much of that is contingent on if you believe that Kathleen Zellner truly has this mission to only defend the innocent. I think that everything in terms of your ability to buy that this is more quote-unquote balanced now, because by balanced, what people are really saying is that they don't, that many people still do not believe in the innocence of Stephen Avery or Brendan Dassey. And if you don't believe that, and, you know, Sarah, I'll be honest, I still am not sure. You know, I don't necessarily have my heart in, you know, one place or the other. You know, it, like, I'm not convinced. I only watched four episodes. Maybe something sort of remarkable came out there. But this is another sort of problem, which once again isn't the filmmaker's fault, but just is the nature of the beast. Now that people are engaged in this story, and now that everybody is sort of the, you know, talented amateur expert on the case of Stephen Avery, if anything had happened to completely exonerate them, or if anything major had happened in either of these cases, it's like a ghost hunting show. You know, anytime you're watching Ghost Hunters, you already know they're not going to find a fucking ghost, because if someone actually found a fucking ghost, you would have heard about it before now. It would have been like when Kim Kardashian got robbed. You know, you already knew about that, so you knew it was coming on Keeping Up with the Kardashians.
Yeah.
It's the same deal here. They're not going to find a ghost. Stephen Avery is not going to walk free. Brendan Dassey isn't going to get out. I mean, Stephen Avery also isn't going to die of hypertension during the show or anything either, because we know everything already. And that creates sort of a you know, it creates a real challenge for people in terms of making, you know, engaging entertainment. I know that's gross, but it is, you guys, it's entertainment. When you're making engaging entertainment and everybody already knows that there aren't going to be any stunning revelations, as opposed to season one where no one knew the story already, like, they're in a lot of trouble, and they have to figure out, you know, a way to get out of it and still be interesting and still tell a story and serve all that. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. There's no way I could do it.
Well, yeah, let's get into the role of Zellner, who everyone is talking about. And I had a couple of different style related back and forths with Crime Writers On host and editrix Rebecca Lavoy a couple days ago, talking about Zellner's manicure, Zellner's seemingly unending. Like, we used to have a joke on Television Without Pity about Buffy just having like an entire room in their house that was used to store her leather coats. And then when Dawn came on the show, that's where Dawn lived, was the coat room. And that, you know, the Good Wife and the Good Fight, like, and don't get me wrong, this is not a complaint, but Zellner is like a real life, like, the Good Fight style icon.
Yeah.
I'm not 100% sure about her hair color narrative. I think she might need a little bit of like highlights and lowlights, just give it a little motion. But, you know, this is like, she is the center of this season, I would say. I don't know if you watched that show that was on MTV, and I can't remember the name of it, but it featured Ryan Ferguson, who was one of her clients, who was also falsely accused and wrongly convicted and was freed. And then he did like Making a Murderer Meets Catfish for MTV. It was actually a pretty good show, and they
that was good.
It.
Yeah. I know it was good, so they didn't pick it up.
But she, you know, she has sort of stepped in for Strang and Buting, not just like literally, but also figuratively as the hyper articulate, fiery heart of this show. But then she's also sort of at odds with them. And I thought those sequences were sort of interesting, where Strang and Buting are just like at a conference table, sort of like they understand that in order to get this conviction vacated, one of the planks in that platform is ineffective assistance of counsel. And they understand that, and they know that it's just business, but they're just sort of like, like, what do you want us to say? We guess that's a good strategy. It makes us look like assholes, though.
It's the ultimate test of the true believer, is like, how, you know, like, how much shit are you willing to eat ego wise if you really are like an activist, you know, defense attorney? So yeah, I was fast. I mean, that to me was some of the best drama of the show right there, was watching them, you know. I like Strang. I like both of those guys. I like them. I did not have an issue with them. You know, if God forbid something happened, you know, to me or someone I love, that's, you know, those guys are who I'd want, you know, for at least some point. I mean, those are the guys I'd get if I did it, is what I'm saying. But Zellner is who I'd get if I didn't.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, a big part of Zellner's role, for lack of a better word, although, you know what, that fits, it's fine. It's not like she's playing someone, like, this is actually who she is and what she does. And she does it on Twitter, which, if it's good enough for the president, fill in the blank. But a big part of her thing is just trying to recreate every single piece of forensic evidence and figure out how the prosecution got to it. And she says that she's trying to find out, like, she really wants to know what happened, because that does make her a more effective advocate. Mm-hmm. But she's not, I did feel confident that she wasn't, like, hoping for a given result to the point where it would affect her judgment or her interpretation of what she was hearing. But some of these reenactments, and you'll see some of these in our visual aids, that's on our social media at Blotter Presents. That some of these reenactments, they didn't quite sink to the level of Jim Clemente getting some 10-year-old to like hit a bewigged skull in the head with a flashlight on that JonBenet show. But it was, they were pretty just, I don't know, ugly, I guess. For lack of a better word, I'm not sure what they proved or disproved. They got some guy who was captioned as the, like, godfather of brain fingerprinting, which I'm like,
I'm so glad you brought this up. I've never heard of this shit. That doesn't mean it's not real, but what, all of that, I had a, it felt a little Jerry Springer-y or something
to
me. Do you know what I mean? It made me, and then, like, the sort of, the guy, you know, said the sort of summary thing, like, you know, I've never seen results as good before, and I was like, you can't do this early in the show because you are shaking my confidence in the quality of everything, you know, to follow.
Yeah. In clip three, Zellner is talking about what she's trying to do in terms of getting her arms around the forensic and physical evidence facts of the case. I actually cut this clip down in the middle because there was a lot of dead time where I think one of her law clerks is trying to recreate the blood spatter inside the back door of the RAV4. And it's just sort of like, if you can't see it, it's not helpful. So I just wanted to be transparent about the fact that I did alter the clip somewhat. But here is Zellner talking about what she's doing and why. And a little petty tag at episode's end that made me like her a whole lot. Here's clip three.
Experimentation in the case is extremely important because you can test the theories of what you think happened. It's like if you could go to a crime scene when it was fresh and you could redo the whole thing. That's what I'm doing. I'm recreating it. Just experiment with it. Because once we get it, it's going to, I think,
click.
Be consistent. Yeah. Okay. One thing I'm 100% sure of, it did not occur the way Mr. Kratz told the jury it occurred. It's demonstrably false what he told them. And I intend to do that on each piece of evidence that he presented to the jury. Because this case, more than anything, more than a case of ineffective assistance of counsel, is a case of gross, extreme, egregious prosecutorial misconduct. And so that will be a real pleasure, like, unmasking Mr. Kratz.
Atta girl, come sit next to us with your beautiful fingernails. I would posit that Mr. Kratz has more than unmasked himself if you're on that side of things, which how can you not be? But as you continue in part two, they do more and more testing, and there's sort of more and more evidence that looks like, even if it wasn't planted, it could have been, that there was opportunity, that there was motive for law enforcement, that there was incompetence by law enforcement. And while all this is going on a parallel track, you have Brendan Dassey's post-conviction attorneys trying to get him out and then trying to get various Supreme Courts and prosecutors to accept that he should be let out and then to get him a bond hearing, and nothing works. But I am not sure. I'm interested to hear from listeners and from you, Eve, whether part two, or at least as much as you've watched so far, moved the ball at all for you in terms of what you think happened, because it did shift things a little bit for me. Do you feel much the same here, like now in the middle of part two, as you did after part one?
No, okay. So one thing that I feel like I have now that I didn't before is a possible other suspect. And I don't know, I guess it's been a while. I don't feel like they gave me like any sort of intimations on who might be responsible instead. Did they make any suggestions about, you know, who might have killed her, or did they just sort of say, "Oh, it wasn't Stephen and Brendan"?
I don't remember either. I think that there was some issue in terms of, and this was part of the ineffective assistance of counsel argument. There was some suggestion that Strang and Buting did not push hard enough on, there was some ruling that the judge made that they weren't allowed to introduce Denny suspects. And Denny is the ruling that says that you can be specific about an alternate theory of the crime, I believe. And I'll put that in the show notes. I actually have to chase down that exact reference.
Well, so
but
by the
Strang and Buting felt that they weren't allowed to talk about alternate theories of the crime. They could only say Stephen Avery didn't do it.
Well, so even if I were just like, you know, a casual viewer of the show and I hadn't been preparing to watch it with you, I think that one of the things that would have hooked me is seeing by the middle of the second episode, they start to drop bait on who is going to be suggested to be the alternate suspects. You start hearing about, oh, so this Pinto's moved, and you start, like, the way that they sort of drop the photo of Brendan's brother?
Yeah.
Yeah. This, like, great-looking Willie Ames type. You sort of, because the thing is, like, at that point, I think I was, like, folding laundry or something, you know, and I had it on, like, on my laptop, and I was like, why are they showing me this, and why are they pointing out the guy in the photo? And I was like, oh, you know, so as we move forward, I was like, okay, so this is that they had an idea of someone else who might have done it, because that's been one of my problems all along, is like, well, somebody had to kill Teresa, and I certainly don't think anyone should get framed for it, but, you know, Stephen, more so than Brendan, seems as possible as anyone, so... you know, it could be, you know, it could be that these cops sort of knew that they had him and they just needed to make sure that they had a good case. And that's why they did what they did. I'm not excusing any of that. Don't do it. But, you know, so that's always sort of been in the back of my head, so that we finally sort of have a, here's some other weird possibilities. That moved the ball for me more than anything else. And
yeah, for sure. I think that some of the things that they came up with, like the fact that a lot of the bones were found on a neighboring property and like on a like neighboring property, like a city quarry property, that the scent dogs went through the quarry first and then back around to the Avery property, that Bobby Dassey had all this really sick shit on his computer, like complete with misspellings, and I think the cops told him it's you or Brendan. It's you or Stephen. So he testified against them both about the timeline and was not questioned on that fact. And there were numerous Brady violations surrounding that. And then, but still, you know, it does seem to me sort of at the end of part one, I was like, he didn't get a fair trial, but I feel like Occam's razor states that he has to have been involved somehow.
Are you saying Stephen or Brendan?
Stephen. I don't really think
Same
Brendan
here.
Had anything to do with anything. And I also think that the theory, like you have a sort of late breaking theory, which, spoiler, causes a dust up amongst the family in a phone call to Stephen in jail, that Barb's new husband, Brandon's stepfather, was involved or knew something. And I mean, some of the alternate theories are not just far-fetched, but in order for them to be executed by, you know, semi-rural law enforcement, nothing against semi-rural law enforcement, but this particular law enforcement structure had proven that they were perhaps not up to the task of a high-profile case, that they would go to these, frankly, like Thomas Harris novelistic lengths and somehow elude detection is not believable. Like, it just doesn't seem like the most logical conclusion or the shortest distance between A and B. But one thing that the documentary does well is to make whatever you think of this, they do a good job making this seem plausible. Here is the somewhat unfortunately named Dr. Carl Reich, explaining how this might happen and kind of bringing it out of the realm of this sounds like a CSI episode that was never shot in clip four.
After you have hypothesized that maybe an item of evidence has been improved or manipulated, the question is, how is that done? And we've discussed how you can physically do it, but another way is to relabel an existing item. So from the unknown parts of the case, they are going to get profiles. Whose profile is it? So you need to get a standard, you need a reference. And so there are reference standards from the defendant. And then there's the actual evidence samples from the crime scene. Most of the samples are swabs. Suppose in a case that one of the reference swabs doesn't make it into the proper envelope. And now you relabel that swab, evidence number 4. So now you've identified the defendant on an item of evidence by simply changing the name on the swab. You haven't physically manipulated anything, you've just changed the name. That's very simple to do. Now you have to have the extra item, you have to lose it in the system. But that happens in cases.
I would like to say that Carl Reich is welcome to come and narrate difficult slash outlandish concepts at my home anytime. Like, I would love him to around and, like, Sarah is attempting a risotto. Here we see that she's already failed by overheating the oil. Like, I mean, I thought that that was an excellent... I know that clip was long, and it might have been sort of the long and diplomatic way of saying they swapped a control swab for a test swab and passed it off as an evidence swab. But I thought that did a lot to make some of these experiments, which could seem like almost ridiculous. I mean, here's clip 5, which is a quick one.
Somewhere I don't see my... Oh. My bucket of scapulas.
I mean, you've got a guy wandering around in literally carefree Arizona with a bucket of cow scapulae, which Kathleen Zellner is then going to shoot at with a .22. Like, some of
Kathleen
this can
Zellner
seem
kinda
a little...
Kathleen Zellner kind of does live the dream.
Yeah, and she actually looks amazing. She has, like, the firing range headset on, the ear protection, and the big Jackie O sunglasses, and yet another leather jacket. She looks great. But some of it can seem a little outlandish, and I think that Making a Murderer Part 2 does an excellent job on two different tracks of very sort of complicated, more complicated than it might seem, post-conviction cases. With a lot of different family members with constantly shifting last names and without necessarily cooperation from some quarters that would be able to clarify things. And I thought it was just as good as and just as captivating as part one and just as well built. It is the same basic brand as part one, and it's just as good, and I rolled through them in no time at all. I thought it was great. I'm not sure it was necessary to go another 10 episodes, but I think it's a very well-made series. But I also feel like a lot of people don't agree that this is the right way to tell this story or the right story to tell. So your mileage may vary, I guess. But if you're wondering if it can be as good, it can. It's a little different, but it's good.
Yeah. I mean, I think I am more inclined to believe that Stephen Dassey did it than you are. Stephen Avery, not Stephen Dassey. I'm with you. I'm dubious that Brendan was involved. But gun to head, I might think Avery did it. I don't know, guys. I really don't know. Decisive, but...
Right, but the question, of course, and you and I think are maybe mm-hmm. more attuned to this particular distinction than... some people. Certainly then apparently juries in Wisconsin, at least the relevant juries here. Sorry, Wisconsin. I've been to you. You're very nice, but I don't want to get arrested there. And that's the truth.
Nope.
But I, you know, if I had to tell someone, like, do you think Stephen Avery did it? It's like, I think he did something. Or I think he knows something. I think
if you asked me if he got a fair trial, I'd say no, though.
But yeah, but if I'm in the jury box and it's like, well, you know, yeah, everybody wants to go home for the long weekend, so all y'all holdouts just go along. It'll be overturned. I still wouldn't be able to vote for him because I don't think based on the evidence that I have that you can say anything. Do I think it's really likely that the cops very carefully collected some blood droplets from his Grotsky sink and his trailer and sprinkled them around? No, I don't think that's likely. But I don't think it's impossible either. And that's reasonable doubt. So
I think you can also watch it and see a good portrait on the impact that being convicted of a crime has on a family, you know, whether
for sure.
or not you think they did it. Like, I think that there are a lot of things there that are a good reminder of, you know, there are a lot of innocent people who are suffering besides Teresa's family, who are, you know, the most important people to this story, even though she's absent from it. You know, when you see what is happening with the Dasseys and the Averys, and, you know, that's another place that the ball has sort of moved for me. They've just gone from, you know, being sad to being like the miles that all of this puts on a person when you have a relative that's part of the correctional system. It's just a good reminder that, you know, don't do crime, kids. Stay in school.
Yeah. I would make a whole bunch of jokes about Eve making me watch our cold case topic, but it was both so terrible and so superfluously terrible that it kind of almost came back around, except not really, because this case is still really disturbing. I am speaking, of course, of Carla Homolka. Here's the case file in case somehow you've recently arrived from a distant planet and don't know who Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka are. Homolka was a Canadian serial killer who raped and murdered at least three minors with her first husband, Paul Bernardo. She was convicted of manslaughter following a plea bargain in the 1991 to 1992 rape murder series, including Ontario teenagers Leslie Mahaffey and Kristen French, as well as the rape and death of her own sister, Tammy. Homolka claimed Bernardo had abused her and made her an unwilling accomplice, receiving, as a result, a sentence of only 12 years, although videotapes later surfaced that demonstrated she was a more active participant than she had admitted. Directed by Joel Bender, who also worked on The Amazing Race, whose first season winner, Brennan Swain, portrayed Bernardo on an episode of The New Detectives? Yeah. Carla, a 2006 release I'd never heard of until last week, seems to take Homolka's word on the nature of her involvement, though star Laura Prepon's performance may not signal what it thinks it does in terms of the ambiguities of Homolka's possible pathology. Homolka was released in 2005 after serving her entire term and with restrictions on her freedom thanks to a chilling absence of remorse or regret, the court made sure to note before turning her loose. Married with a child, she now lives under another name in Quebec. Bernardo's first parole hearing went just as you'd have hoped, and he remains in custody as of this recording. This movie is not good. And yet it's not, I mean, it is often boring and it can be a little bit disturbing. And here's why. Eve, I don't know if you would agree with this, but I'm going to play a clip of the framing device of this movie is that she is meeting with a psychiatrist, I guess, employed by the parole board, and their conversations lead to flashbacks where her like side of things is filled in. The psychiatrist is played by Patrick Bachow of The Pretender.
Oh, I just call him the poor man's Udo Kier. Is he has a real name?
Okay. Yes, apparently he does. He he's definitely one of those, like, if you watch enough, like, Belgian,
yeah,
like, crime, like, scripted crime, you're like, oh yeah, that guy. The guy playing Paul Bernardo is Misha Collins, who I think Supernatural fans are quite familiar with as Castiel. He's completely miscast here and not believable and directed so badly in the actual, like, scenes where he's committing felonies. But it's like a bad production of West Side Story. But here's the first clip, and I'd like to hear your take on what you think the movie thinks it's doing.
What is that?
Shut up. He's on me.
Something wrong?
Yeah. I want you to fuck me.
Yeah. You want me to fuck you?
Yeah.
What if I were a rapist?
Oh, cool. Put it inside.
Paul said, what if I were a rapist? And you responded, oh, that'd be cool.
Come on, Doc. Don't tell me you've never heard of talking dirty.
All right. First of all, don't be one of those movies that has someone call a doctor Doc. Literally nobody does this in real life. It's only on TV. Second of all, I really feel like this movie thinks that it's like an episode of the Red Shoe Diaries on some level. Tonally, it's just way off to me.
It was like someone just saw Basic Instinct, right down to like her. Well, I mean, it's Laura Prepon, so it's not like she's the most active actor. I mean, but it was, you know, but we've all seen that scene of the interrogation scene of Basic Instinct. There's Laura Prepon. She's sitting there with a cigarette, and there's just, and it's the deadpan delivery, you know, like, what, are you going to arrest me? You know, like, what are you going to do to stop me from smoking? Of course you can't smoke in there. I mean, you can't, can you smoke in Canada? Maybe you can smoke everywhere in Canada. I don't know. The whole thing, it's like, they were going for that amoral killer, and, you know, there was that other Basic Instinct echo towards the end where she's in the dance club, too. But then at the same time, it's like, oh no, Carla was also beaten, and it's also sad. It's like, pick a characterization and go with it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that nobody in Canada, because they called this deal that she made with prosecutors the deal with the devil, because these videotapes surfaced and it was pretty clear that she had, you know, that she wasn't a hostage. And then they were, you know, her release was protested. Like, at the time that these parole hearings took place, it was before 2005, and her parole was rejected because she still had the wrong affect and never reached out to the victim's families to apologize. And Laura Prepon's performance is sort of like Farrah Fawcett's as Diane Downs, in that her limitations, let's say, in terms of her elasticity of expression, play perfectly into this kind of surfacey, self-serving, like, saying what you have to say to get what you want personality. Like, it's good for that portrayal, but if this movie is trying to get us on her side, which, given that her name is the title, I think it is, maybe you want someone else to actually play her who seems maybe a little remorseful or more convincingly broken or not this. But this is that clip that I just played was, I would say, the least sort of, I think we're supposed to think that this is like transgressively hot.
Well, so Misha Collins, you know, who, there's this whole cottage industry of supernatural conventions and all of this stuff. And the only reason I know this is because I Googled. I haven't been to one, guys. But as part of that, I think he probably does run out of things to talk about. But also, I think, as we all know, people who watch Supernatural are very passionate about the show and good at looking things up on the internet. So many people who have gone to these conventions have asked Misha Collins about the film. Misha Collins says he regrets. So the link is in the show notes for you, Sarah. There's actually a little video bit you can watch where he talks about how he regrets making the movie, and he specifically calls out the director for, as he said, making the director during the shooting saying that the rape scene should be hot. So this is something that Collins has specifically said. I did not, if I had known this before, when we were discussing it, I wouldn't have even suggested we watch it. After I saw that, which was when I was doing research this afternoon, I was just like, fuck this guy.
Well,
not Misha Collins, but the director.
No, definitely not. And Misha Collins, like, I mean, I'm not a regular Supernatural watcher, but sometimes it's like awesome hotel TV, which is like, well, I have 20 minutes before the next meeting and I got to change my stockings and, oh, this is on. Oh, they're still cute and this is funny. And which one of them is technically dead right now? Mm-hmm. Misha Collins, there are certain scenes in which he is not even trying, and knowing that this is why, kind of changes the whole movie.
Yeah.
For me, that he's like doing this protest basically on camera that was not edited out because the production team is really not good at this at all.
And also the hair thing. I mean, the thing is, if you're a person who's ever had hair or thinks you might have hair, when you watch this movie, you'll be supremely bothered because of all the clip-in bangs. And it's like no one on set had a curling iron or some hairspray. The best they could do is Claire's Boutique bangs that were clipped in. And some of the situations on Misha Collins' hair later as the show progresses, you're just like, I don't know. The people who made this film have a lot to answer for, and a lot of the people who wrote this film and the director of this film, they should feel bad. Did you also notice that Brandon Routh is in the movie with his old nose?
Oh, yeah, I saw him in the credits. Who even was he? Was he their, like, drug-dealing partner?
No. So when she goes to the club at the end and says, like, oh, now I feel so much better, and she's dancing with that tall, skinny guy with a huge nose, that's Brandon Routh.
Totally missed that. Although by the time I saw the credits and I was like, oh, but then that was like at the opposite end of the movie. And I feel like I'd been through so much with the many, many blue gels. And it just looked like someone microwaved a koosh ball and stuck it on the front of Prepon's head. We all know what bangs were usually going to look like in 89, 90. Like we lived it. I had those bangs. I gotcha. But the director, I'm not saying that Prepon could necessarily have done a lot better, but some of the line deliveries are like, nobody wants another take. Nobody.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here's our last clip. Wait for it. You'll see.
I knew it wasn't going to stop.
Paul says you killed Caitlin Bross, beating her with the mallet that he left you.
You know that's not true.
Many people think it is the truth, Carla. These Toronto detectives think you're the murderer, not Paul. So does the FBI profiler and the RCMP supervisor.
Well, fuck them.
This is a movie that was released in theaters. Yeah. This was in movie theaters. This is the thing that's crazy to me, because it is... It feels like it's way older. Like, you keep going back thinking, really, just 2000? I mean, because you know how old, like, you know, Laura Prepon is, and you know how old, you know, Misha Collins is. So you think, okay, well, this had to be from the 70s or something, because it's so shitty. Everything about it is so shitty.
Yeah.
It was released in theaters. Yeah.
And it's so, like, I just kept writing in my notes before I stopped taking them, which was fairly early in the proceedings, because why? Like, who is this for? I mean, first of all, anyone who is familiar with the case is not going to pay to see this. Like, I am shocked that it didn't go straight to Cinemax. Like, people are screaming the word cunt at each other, and there's gratuitous violence against women. These sexual assault scenes, which ended in the deaths of minor children, are played as like, again, like a Red Shoe Diaries North. It's fucked up. The Anthony Hopkins Hello Clarice imitation that's happening with the guy playing the shrink is like snowballing. It's at its peak in the clip you just heard. And then she has this like Valley Girl delivery, like, well, fuck them. Like, okay, what are we doing here? I just, it's really bad. It's really bad. And I don't understand who it's for. And let me just recommend the Law and Order episode based on this case starring Ellen Pompeo. It might actually be SVU. Either way, I'll put it in the show notes and correct myself, but she is marrow freezing as the Homolka character. Her line delivery about like a bracelet belonging to the sister. I mean, like, I don't know what she's up to on Grey's Anatomy. I haven't watched that show since the first of its 98 seasons, but she should be making the big bucks just for that. Eve, where else can listeners find you and your work?
Well, if you're interested in the media, if you want to go to inside.com/media, you can subscribe to my weekday Inside Media podcast. If you're in San Francisco or interested in the San Francisco Bay Area, I also do a daily San Francisco news email newsletter. It's a inside.com/SF. So you can subscribe to those. And if you ever find yourself in San Francisco, I own a store called Avenues Dry Goods on Irving Street between 42nd and 43rd Avenues. We specialize in local artisan creations, usable stuff, neat stuff, stuff that is affordable, as well as some vintage and upcycled goods.
Very good. Thank you for coming back to discuss this hot property on Netflix and this very much not property on YouTube, which I might not even link to in the show notes.
It's just that bad.
It really is just that bad. Things that aren't bad, upcoming episodes. Mike Dunn is back to talk about history's Watergate event and Chris Hayes on Watergate. Stephanie Green returns to talk about Dr. Death and Gypsy's Revenge, Toby Ball on Jonestown, Julian Gross on Dirty John, and so much more. Till then, if you have a tip for the Blotter Presents, find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. You can email me at bunting@the-blotter.com, and you can become an official Blotter tipster at the Patreon page. That's patreon.com/blotterpresents. If you like the podcast, I'd love it if you tell a friend and rate it on iTunes. If you don't like the podcast, please find a well and yell that information down it. My guest has been Eve Beatty, and she's on Twitter at Eve B. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.